Go Loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we're going to have Anthony Smith, owner of Mr. Fox, Mr. Fox's new Irish whiskey, and Dallier Street, Michelin star Dallier Street in Dublin, joining us. Anto's worked on the restaurant off
and
camera.
Mr. Fox, he owns the restaurant, right?
He owns Mr. Fox, which is a cracker. He originally would open that with Stevie and Andrea from the Pig's Ear, but he's the sole owner there now. And I've known Anto. You probably know Anto yourself, do you?
Do you know, I was on a trip a few years ago. It sounds like I was on a trip.
Yeah, you're always going somewhere.
This was a good few years ago. We were in Barcelona together. We actually can't remember why we were over there. We were over there to see some type of a food company anyway. And we hung out for a couple of days. Look, an absolute gentleman. He's from Blanchardstown, right in Donegal. I think he's a big family, similar to me. We were probably starting our careers in and around the same time. Yeah. You know? So it's looking forward to getting he's still
a very precise cook, man.
I've
done a good bit of years. He did a good few years off camera. Like, we all kind of have a chef, and right, obviously him and Stevie go way back to One Pico days, as far as I know. And so he was always kind of in with Stevie, and then he'd hop around, but just, he's like a mad scientist. Everything weighed, measured, gas, but
and we are
brilliant
getting
palate.
Lots of positive feedback when we have chefs on. I think people are enjoying hearing the
behind the scenes nitty gritty.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll obviously have our culinary conundrums and cookbook corner, so don't go anywhere. All right, so it is cookbook corner time, Gaz. I think it's your turn. We cannot keep losing the run of ourselves. Of who's
I always
this, but anyway,
feel
got
when
one
you ask
head.
Me that question that it's loaded. You're like, I'm not to be going, I thought I'd done last. No, it is my turn. And you know, Gary, I'm probably the same as yourself. I own way too many cookbooks, and I will never, ever, ever throw one away. Because I'm constantly being asked by my wife, why aren't you, like, surely you don't need them anymore. But it's when you don't need one is when you actually need it. And every cookbook has a recipe in it that you will find. I've never bought a cookbook that I've regretted. So, but this cookbook that I'm going to talk about now is one that I forgot I owned. And I only remembered I owned it because I was somewhere when I seen the place. So it's the Wolseley in London.
Yeah.
It's right beside the Ritz over in London. There's a hotel. And it's very, well, it's famous for me for breakfast. That actually serves lunch and dinner as well. But I remember I was brought to the Wolseley as a young chef. I was in my early 20s maybe, and we were over in London for eating for some reason. And I was like, oh, you have to go to the Wolseley. And it's just a very classical room and very classical service, and serving lots of classical things. Like, so they do, you know, grilled kippers and poached haddock and kedgeree and all these wonderful old-fashioned breakfast dishes. And of course they do smoked salmon and scrambled eggs and eggs benedict. And there's recipes for a lot of those dishes that I just said in that cookbook. But really, it's only a little small A5 cookbook. You can buy it when you're in the restaurant. But you know, there's a wonderful hollandaise sauce recipe in there. There's how to poach an egg in there. It comes in a little sleeve. And what really I like about cookbooks, or owning cookbooks, is that they're always whenever you buy a cookbook, it's because you've heard of something, or you're interested in somebody, or you're working somewhere. And like, when I look at my cookbooks through the years, I see the ones that I bought when I lived in Australia, or when I was a commie, or as I got a little bit older and I started managing kitchens, I buy cookbooks that I think my team will be inspired for. So I bring them in and I just get, you know, it says, here, have a read of that and see, can you pick something up? So I think from a chef's point of view, everybody thinks we probably go out and buy these super technical cookbooks, and we do, right? It's chefs that buy them. But you will also buy ones that are very specific for something. And the reason why I bought that one is because I love the Wolseley breakfast so much. And it's loaded with all those recipes. So if I ever really want to think about a very classic, someone asked me to write a menu about it, something really classically, even though I know it all, jumping into that, you'll see a presentation, or you'll see how something is done.
And that's the big thing about cookbooks for chefs, isn't it? Like, sometimes you just need to see
something,
one little tiny detail could be a duck fat chip or something.
And whatever it is.
It throws you into...
And it'll just get, like, you know, the first thing I done when I moved to, or when I got my job in the marker, I got this blank office, probably twice the size of the one we're in now. Yeah, that's a joke. We're in a very large office. It's a small office that has a desk and a couple of computers. But I wrapped all the walls with shelves and it's just loaded with cookbooks. So when my guys are thinking of specials or something's going on or I'm asked to write a menu, I'll just take out a book and I'll flick through a few pages and very quickly it'll just get the creative process going. So my one this week is the Wolseley. If you're ever in London and you want to go and eat a very, very good breakfast, it isn't cheap, but it's a very classical place to have breakfast. You get a very warm welcome by a concierge and you go into this wonderful old marble, kind of would remind you of Hawksmoor in Dublin a little bit, I think, but even older again, but it's a beautiful restaurant.
Yeah.
And very, very old world service. So kind of cool, probably making myself sound a little bit fuddy-duddy, but it is, it's a cool place and it's a very cool cookbook.
Deadly. Good shout. Okay, so it is time for our interview. And joining us today is a cat that I've worked a couple of days with here and there, the owner of Mr. Fox. If anybody's been lucky enough, if you're either having a baby in and around Parnell Square or you're lost trying to find Chapter One, but the best restaurant, I think, in that neck of the woods is Mr. Fox. Anthony Smith, you're very welcome to Dishing It Out.
Thank you very much. It's great.
Also, Big Balls owner, Dottier Street, should I say Michelin Star?
Yeah, Michelin Star.
Now, that's my Donegal tone saying it. How do you like in your distinguished
Dallier,
North?
Dallier Street is what it's called,
Thank Dallier. You for correcting them there.
It's a French Huguenot name.
Yeah. Dottier Street, yeah.
All the Nordy said.
We went to fancier schools in Donegal, so yeah. I'm probably saying it right. How do you say it in Dublin?
Dallier. Yeah, we call it Dallier. What it's called.
Dallier Street, yeah.
Wow.
It's a fucking restaurant, so.
No, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm just saying like that's mad. I've been, you're probably been like wincing anytime you've ever heard me talk about it.
No, but all of them do it. You kind of,
but I would say nearly all your guests as well coming or saying Dallier Street.
A lot of people,
What's it mean?
It's named after Jeremiah Dallier. He was a French Huguenot. He set up the Bank of Ireland and stuff like that. So the French Huguenots are Protestant refugees that came to Ireland.
I hope you have no prods in there. Yeah.
Plenty of them, I say, you know.
Slagging. I'm joking.
Whoa.
Calm down, prods. Calm down.
And Parnell was a Protestant as well, and I named Mr. Fox after him. So
Actually, on Mr. Fox, because originally, obviously, I would have known about all the exciting happenings around Mr. Fox when we were filming the restaurant.
Yeah.
What's also not here is Anto, for many years, worked on the restaurant TV show. Him and Stevie go back a long way. And Andrea, who owned the Pig's Ear and Spitalfields, they were your original partners in Mr. Fox, right?
They backed me in opening Mr. Fox. You know,
brilliant.
They funded the opening. So they gave me my opportunity, my big opportunity. Now I work for them in the Pig's Ear
for
almost
right.
2 years. And I also worked with Stephen and Mon Pico before I went to America. And me and Stephen are great friends and stuff like that. And him and Andrea backed Mr. Fox, you know.
Brilliant.
How long ago? When was that?
It's nearly 9 years now. Yeah.
Wow, is it that long ago? Wow. The years rock on.
And that's when I first mentioned the restaurant show before I even opened Mr. Fox.
But you know, like I think back, like I was brought on to do one episode of the restaurant and that's 14 years ago. You know what I mean? Yeah, like it's one episode has lasted 14, 15 years if it's to come back this year. But but obviously they've moved on now. You're the sole owner.
Yeah, like, they gave me the opportunity to buy them out and stuff like that. So
brilliant.
I took that opportunity and then I opened Dallier Street like 4 or 5 years later with Jimmy, and he was a chef that worked with me in New York and Mon Pico.
Yeah.
He's from Australia. And he rang me during lockdown, you know, everybody's kind of, what we're going to do?
Yeah.
Is this ever going to come back to normal? And he's like, I want to open my own restaurant. And he was head chef in a place called Datura in Manhattan. It's 2 Michelin star.
Yeah.
And I was like, come to Dublin, you know, we'll get you a restaurant here, you know. And we did it. We got Dallier Street, Dallier Chambers, but it's on Dallier Street. And we set it up, and then within a year, got a Michelin star.
So. And when did that actually open?
2021, so about 3 years now.
Like just no, coming out of COVID, was it? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, the last lockdown was probably in January, and we opened in December kind of thing.
Because I remember all the talk of it at the time, you know, like when we were all still figuring out takeaway food and all the other stuff that you were getting caught up in. And then there was talk of what you guys were doing. And yeah. I was like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But then I suppose there was such a, pardon the pun, an appetite for people to get back out dining.
People gasping for it to get back into restaurants.
Yeah. Especially to eat fine cuisine and the like, which is obviously the market that you are in there.
Yeah, big time, yeah. And the Michelin star helped a lot, you know.
Did they?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Like, anybody can fill a restaurant Friday, Saturday, but it's the midweek.
Yeah, for sure.
And you get a lot of international visitors that would look for a Michelin star and stuff like that. And,
what about the conversation around the being a double-edged sword? Like,
I think the pressure's big, you know. So if you wilt under pressure, you lose everything because it relies so much on the chef and Jane, the people that run the place, and Scott and Conrad. So like if you buckle under the pressure, but like the pressure is, like I keep making it simple, like just do what you do. Nothing's changed.
Yeah.
You just got an accolade. Just do what you do. That's what they recognize rather than the star controls you. So it keeps getting better. It keeps, there's innovation happening all the time, especially now, like the early years of getting a star. It's still very progressive and loads of changes all the time. They're not stuck with the same dishes, you know. When you go to 2-star, 3-star, the menu stays the same basically.
And what about the pressure around, like, and I mean this is going to sound a little bit industry, so if you're not in the industry, you know, I'm not boring you with this, but like the pressure around the linen, the crockery, the uniforms, and I know they say the 4-star is not that.
Yeah,
I don't know whether I can't believe that's solely true, because
if you're walking to waiters with smelly uniforms and chefs with filthy clothes, because it's an open space, haven't been in it yet, right? So it's an open kitchen and it's a chef's table, it's like a bar. So they prepare everything in front of you, and the chef serves the food.
Yeah,
they'd run the food, they'd explain the dishes. So it's very interactive. You can really get a sense of, and if you get it up close, it's like a symphony, you know, because everything, you can't go like that.
Take your
finger. Or, there's lots of tweezers and. And that's his style of food, small plates and stuff like that. So, you're right. Like, they won't give it to a smelly restaurant. They won't give it to a smelly restaurant. But most people that kind of are at that level want to open that kind of fine dining restaurants. Do you think so?
Yeah,
a lot of ethnic cuisine is kind of more homely food and stuff like that. And they're not aiming for the star. They just get the star because the cooking is excellent.
Because I know, like, over the years, there has been statements made by Michelin when, you know, I was in Thailand during the summer, and like the crab omelette place that just does the crab omelette, and it's one lady making this omelette, and you know, and then there's the chicken place that does the chicken that's cooked in the master stock and then deep fried, and it's out of a van. But they're not charging you £120 for a tasting menu, right? It is what it is. It has a star.
Yeah.
We'd argue that's probably a bib rather than a star, because
We're used to stars being the lecker vans, the chocolates, the greenhouses, you know. But over there, it does say the best in its category, or good cooking in its category. So it would be categorized as street food, that guy you're talking about. And that's, he's the best of the best in that. You know?
There's
only one hawker with that Michelin star. And that's, they do say it's for the category, but we're used to it being the elite restaurants.
And that's why everybody in Ireland, anyway, like you go abroad or you go to England or you go further afield here, there and everywhere. And as you said, if you go back to the traditional sense of the Michelin, what we would have done when we were younger in our early 20s or whatever, you were looking at the uber consistency and the fineness of Chapter 1, Le Cravan and so on. Yeah. Then you see another one and you're like, here, hold on a minute.
Yeah, it's not that.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right. Even France, like Paris, I mean, there's Michelin star gaffes up the yin yang, like in different little parts of France, and the food's fucking cat.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird, man, you know, but look, at the same time, I can imagine that's really annoying as well now when you're holding a star, like going, people are like going, you know, they can diminish the thoughts of it or whatever, but you know, you've got your style that's got you a star and it's up against whatever.
But the expectation for people is huge because we do charge for it, you know, it is really expensive. It is like, for an ordinary person, it's once a year, maybe.
An accepted thing, right?
Yeah, so we know we have standards to maintain, and we have to back it up.
You have to hit them,
If you ever went there, it feels friendly, it feels homely, the welcome's great, big smile.
I know you've asked us to go in, but we'll definitely come and visit, but I know loads of people that have eaten there, and everyone says the same thing.
Yeah.
Incredible level of detail, loads
we
of flavour.
We disarm people. People have this expectation, it's going to be stuffy and you know, they have that kind of feeling almost. Yeah, not everybody, but some people that aren't used to that dining, we disarm them straight away. Big smile. Yeah.
Well, that's what you got to do.
And then they're sitting down, everybody's super friendly, everybody's hello thing. It's not, like in a New York, remember, it's a beautiful girl at reception, and I was kind of like, what's your name and what's your booking? And you're like, ooh. And then you're told to stand there. And I'm like, what's going on? But I was like, we're not doing that here.
Yeah.
We're serious food, but we're also Irish. Yeah. We're welcoming. Yes. We have a big smile on our face, disarm people, and it really works.
I feel in Michelin, right? Like, that has definitely changed, even in the very high level restaurants.
Yeah.
Like,
it's kind of been
2 and 3. I mean, 3 maybe not, but definitely in. I've been lucky enough to eat in a 2-star twice this year.
Yeah.
And it was one of them in particular was very, very old. Well, I was in the Ritz only recently.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I've been there.
Yeah. And I mean, it was very much, but it was friendly. The service was very friendly. Very, very detailed.
Yeah.
And very old world. There was a lot of table service and whatever. Yeah. But I was surprised and a little bit taken aback of how at times I've almost felt casual.
Yeah.
Because I know if I'd have eaten there.
I think they're trying to get a sense of you.
Yeah, right.
Not everybody serves the same way.
Yeah, no, for
sure. You know, they feel you're a bit of crack and you're happy to be there. They'll soften it. And I remember being there and he gave us a crepe Suzette on the house.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
We went there before we got the 4-star.
Yeah.
As like, we're going to celebrate. We're going to London. We went to Heston and went there because it's the 4-star. It's the only time you're ever going to feel the same. So you got 4-star, Oscar.
Yeah, right.
We're going to tee it up. And we got to train up to Manchester the next morning, you know. But I was like, if we're doing this, we're going.
Yeah.
Going all in.
And I just
said. We're leaving bankrupt.
Well, yeah. No, I know. Please let the money come in now. Because the economy is having a wobble as well. And the Ukraine, what you know from the cost of everything, the wages.
Yeah.
And we were, I'm not saying close to the edge, but like it was tight, you know.
Yeah.
And after that, it was kind of like, we were the only Michelin star in Dublin that year. So that helped a lot.
New star.
I tell you what,
you were quick out the blocks because I had a reservation for my sister-in-law and I think I got an email a day later. Right. Price change. I started laughing. My bollocks.
No, they honored the prices for 2 months. They did honor the price for 2 months and then they put it up a bit. But like it was underpriced for what it was anyway.
Sure.
I think it's 85 quid for 14 dishes. You know?
That's the dance. Yeah. You know, because we have to
deliver. You know, if you're going and spend that coin, like you have to deliver.
It's the wine list as well. I think that gets you go into a different.
You can buy nicer stuff. Yeah. You can buy like the 1,000 euro bottles and stuff like that and put them on the list and you shift them.
Yeah.
And the cake club was almost a crazy list there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to go back a little bit to like, how did it all kind of to begin? Like, how didn't all start at Michelin star? Like, where did your career start?
I think I started in pubs and restaurants. My cousin was a chef and he got me into it. I just finished school, didn't know what I was doing. He knocked at the door. Do you want to be a commie chef? I didn't even know what it was. So I had no idea.
You from Dublin, Anto?
Yeah, I'm from Blanchardstown. Yeah. So it was he and I was out in Rathaut, County Meath. So it was only just the back of Blanchardstown nearly. And I loved it. It was like McDonald's. I worked my first job at McDonald's. I loved it when I was 15. I got promoted to manager at 16. I used to count all the money at McDonald's in Blanchardstown. And it was one of the busiest McDonald's in the country. And I loved it. And I loved it. It's kind of like kitchens. The back of house, front of the house, all that kind of vibe. And they'd only respect you or talk to you if you're good at something. You know? So I always had to get good. That's without cleaning the tables. Yeah. And your mates are looking at you and stuff. So, but I love that. I love that. The systems of McDonald's and stuff like that. I always say every special job ever, I was like, McDonald's was deadly. Because all my mates in school, we finished school at 4. We'd go to Blanchardstown because we live right beside it. And we'd start at 5 o'clock for our shifts. And then we'd do the weekends and stuff. Then cousin got me a job. I loved that. And then I think it was about 20 I started working. So I went to Australia and I applied for a place and I didn't know what level it was. So I just needed a job and it was in the paper at that time. It wasn't the internet or anything. It's 2003 or something like that.
And where was that? Where did you
work? In Sydney in Australia. It's a place called Belmondo.
Yeah, no.
Belmondo had 2 hats and I was like, I went to the interview and I was in the Rocks in Sydney. It's all the part of Sydney. It's where they first settled it. On Circular Quay, they brought the train to and I'm like, holy God, what's this? And I went up in the interview. It was in the oldest warehouse in Australia. And it was on the top floor. And I went in. The chef brought me out to the balcony. And it's overlooking the Sydney Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. It's been the best views in Sydney. And that's where the interview was. And the interview was quick, fresh. Where'd you work? What you doing? And he was Irish now. I didn't know him. And he gave me a tomato and a shallot. It's a concasta and and then you'd see what level you're at, you know. Gave me a job. And at the interview, he says, I don't open packets. And I was like, all right. He's like, we make our own passes, stock, shoes, all that kind of stuff. And
there's somebody opening for you.
And it was one that was like, if I'm a serious, this is serious, right? And I never worked to that level before because you'd be watching Gordon Ramsay on TV, Boiling Points.
Yeah.
And you'd be actually terrified of going in there and getting lashed out of it, you know? But it wasn't like that, you know? They take you
on board, they teach you. The corner.
Where?
There in 2003.
Where?
I was just left the Radisson up on Pitt Street.
Yeah, I know.
And then I went down to Woolloomooloo. I was in the W Hotel down in Woolloomooloo. In 2003, I was there from 03 to 06.
Very good, very good.
And I worked for Peter Doyle.
Yeah.
I used to stage because I was there for 6 years, so I was tied to a visa. And at the time over there, you couldn't really get sponsored through a restaurant because the sponsorship, the business had to generate, I think it was 2.5 million.
Okay.
And a lot of the restaurants didn't want to open their books.
Yeah, yeah.
So they used to just take fellas in and girls in for like 3 months.
Okay.
And then there was a little bit of you could stay for six months and pretend you were a kitchen porter. And, But yeah, that's gas, man. We were working around the corner feature. Where did you go for a pint?
Somewhere down the rocks. And then we went up to King's Cross and stuff like that. Cheap drinks and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. Sydney, there was a lot of stuff happening with food in 2003 in Sydney.
Yeah, yeah. It was after the Olympics. So I had that and the investment and the chefs and the restaurant. I couldn't believe the food when I got there.
Well, across there in the Opera House, it was Bennelong, I think, was the restaurant. And that got his third hat.
Yeah, that year.
Which really was the equivalent of a 2-star restaurant.
Yeah.
So one hat I always felt what I never felt it was quite a Michelin star, but it was very close. And then a two-hat restaurant.
Yeah.
It was a really good 1-star. I think people understand that will know what I mean. But it's a very ingredient-led cooking country, which I really learned about produce when I lived there and worked there.
And I think they got fusion right. Over here, fusion was like noodles with a piece of fish. They didn't know it was sweet chili sauce. Yeah, but over there it was like, we're just going to amplify French food with Asian ingredients. And it was really, really well done. And you see it now, the French really adapted Japanese ingredients into their cooking stuff.
But there's a massive amount of Japanese people living in Australia
he was the king. He was number two in the world or something.
And Neil Perry was down in Rockville, which is just across me. I mean, he's opened like a lot of burger restaurants
done well, hasn't he? One thing that always stood out to me, Anto, about you was precision. You were obsessed with recipes. The one thing that stood out for me, even if it was bacon a spud, you weighed everything. Where did that come from? Was that New York?
That was America.
America came after Australia?
No, I came back and I had that kind of, I need to work in a good restaurant. You know? And I was only 22 or something. I got back and around me mate, because I got just a job in a 4-star hotel. I got me a job in Davenport, and Davenport wasn't at the races at all. I remember I was only 22, so like, we're going to do a nice a la carte at dinner time. I want you to write the menu. I was like, you're asking me to write the menu. I was like, all right. So I wrote menus, dishes that I did in Australia.
Wontons.
No. The chef was very French, basic, but Australian influence, you know, a bit of, I was put some fresh sea bass or sea bream on the menu. And then he's like, no, he's a Kiwi as well. He's like, mate, come out here. I want to show you. He's double chest freezer opened up and there's about 7,000 tuna steaks in there, brown ones with the bone in the middle of it. Because we need to get rid of this first. And I'm like, I can't walk here. But then there was the guy, the head maitre d' of the hotel was Eamon O'Reilly's uncle.
No worry.
And I knew, someone told me about One Pico and I started going on the internet. I was like, this looks amazing.
I love One Pico,
And I asked him, I was like, listen, they're looking for the junior pastry chef and I have a bit of pastry experience. Will you ask your nephew for an interview? So he said, when he liked me a bit, like a grafter and, you know, took a shine to me. And then he set up the interview and I got the job and I started off junior pastry chef there. But in like 3 months, I was the head pastry chef there. The whole kitchen team left and Stephen McAllister came in.
Oh, right.
And I'd never met anybody like Stephen before. Stephen was like 27.
He must have came there from Lecrovan, did he?
No, he number 10.
He owned number 10, yeah.
He had number 10, but that closed. And before that, he's already on TV.
Stevie was cocked to walk.
4-star hotel, his own restaurant. He's like 27 and he's Shelburne, from Council State, like me. So I took big inspiration from Stephen. Like, I was like,
Kilbarrack posse.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the story, same stories, egg, chips, and beans on a Wednesday because you had no money. I didn't know food in the house because the shopping night was Thursday for us, you know. So loads of kind of, and became great friends, you know. And like, I was supposed to go to the Dillon Hotel that first opened with the team, the One People team. And Stephen was like, are you still going? And he bought in a baby pig and he chopped it all up, made six little pieces out, a little sausage, a little rack, a little tete de cochon. I'd never seen anything like that. and there's an assiette of pork, a suckling pig, and I was I want to learn that.
Yeah,
you know. And I remember that, like, I was like, whoa, I'd never seen that. Like,
he's a very good cook, Stevie.
Very technical.
Yeah,
very
he's deadly.
Yeah.
To be fair, like, he really is. I mean, we're always slagging one another, and there's always a bit of acting the maggot going on in the kitchen, the restroom. But the one thing that stands out about Stevie's flavour, like, he can pull it out.
Learned his craft, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. You can always tell. Like,
he had two kids. He was 27. Like, it was like, if you lived tree lice already, you know.
Yeah,
I was like, how the hell did you do that? And I gravitated towards him because I wanted to be like that, you know. I'm still young. I was like, oh, I want to learn how to do that, you know. How did he figure out? But nobody showed him. Just one of those people. Play for five star hotel, and I'll get
stones
on TV and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, and then I went to Le Crevin because I feel like I need to hit the Michelin level then. And I worked for Stephen Gibson then, and that was incredible. It's like 18 chefs, and I'd never seen anything like that, you know. But I remember going to be trial in Le Crevin, I burnt my hand.
Trying to hide it.
Well, like, the trial was, you're down there prepping in the morning. They start at 8 o'clock or half eight, and prepping in the morning. Like, okay, come on upstairs now. I was like, oh, upstairs. Oh, great. And I'm like, that's a lunch menu. Okay, you're on the sauce. Okay, for lunch. And I was like, we've 60 booked.
And he put you
and I was on the pastry section in one bagel. But I could cook. Like, I was only going to go on the pastry section because that was the job they had, you know. But I could cook, you know. And I did my trial and 60 thing. And I was like, you know, when you time travel 2 hours, you don't know how you got there sweating.
Yeah.
Or your lunch is over.
Sounds very like the day Simon did. Really did hung over in pied a terre, was it, or something?
Yeah.
The slam dish for lunch service.
I did great because he said to me, I have no idea where you work, but I can cook. So listen, do you want a job and stuff like that? And I was like, yeah, great. And he put me on the sauce straight away in Le Crevin.
Wow.
It wasn't the start of the ladder. I was on the sauce.
And for people that are listening, that's where it's at.
Well, that's usually the holy grail, you know, takes you a while.
Normally you have to work in the kitchen for like at least 6 months.
I think
months.
I was kind of lucky someone was leaving, and then the other lad that was on it was struggling a little bit, you know. And Derry was gas. Derry being there for every service, you know. But he wouldn't know their names. Like, hell, you. It would be gas. He wouldn't be mean around. And he's like, where's Anto's? He off tonight. Get him in here. And this fella can't do it. And somebody telling me the next day, and they'd be slagging each other, you know, because it would be not ruthless.
Such a good guy,
Derry. In check, you know, because everybody's going after.
Nothing
you know?
Like hearing that when someone missed you on your day off. You're like, especially when the boss
like Derry, you know. Yeah. Derry was great. And then after that led to Mint. I went to Mint then on pastry.
Who was there? Was that Dylan?
Yeah. Oh, I've never seen anything like that.
Right? Yeah.
Well, like the first time I ever went to Mint, I went to my girlfriend for her birthday or my birthday. And he brought him nine different types of bread. I was like, what's this? How many of these can you have? Yeah, I'm going to on the plate, the little plate.
And, Dylan was off his rocker.
I've never seen that, and it's so aggressive in my life. Now, Dylan would tell you now, he probably went overboard.
Probably.
But he was very
One story from there, Damien Ring was involved. I don't know if you know Damien Ring.
I don't know him personally, but I know.
Yeah, but...
How long were you there for?
We won't talk about that.
I was probably there for about 4 months. And the reason why I left... And I went to Mint before Le Crevin, actually. And the reason why I left is because he won an award, Best Chef or something. And we were there, I was there early because the week before, I didn't have the best week. So I was like, I'm going to get in there early, 7:30. So I'm hiding out in the shed, the little shed on the laneway down Ranelagh. And I was freezing. And the lads supposed to start, I thought he'd be there early, but like the lads started showing up then. And then Dylan never showed up. He hit the key to the restaurant. And he showed up at 10:30. And he growled.
Time was lunch, 12 o'clock.
Like that. And opened the door. I didn't even say hello to him and walked off, went home because he's hung over. He probably went on a rampage after New York. And then one of the guys left the charge. He'd been a bit of an asshole to me. I was like, you know what?
Yeah, fuck off.
And then I rang my friend that worked like around and I need a job. And And like around was totally in a different environment.
That's just Stevie Gibson's just.
Yeah, he's very calm. Yeah. Technically excellent. The food was excellent. Totally different. And that probably suited me.
Was Quanji there at that time or Garrett Galligan be any chance? No.
No.
They would have worked
with
Stevie when Big Shimmy Commons was around.
Yeah, no.
He was the head chef after or before Stephen.
Yeah. So that was probably the peak of Le Crevin, you know.
Yeah. God, it was a brilliant chef. It's a shame like that COVID robbed Sally Ann and Derry. They would have had a good year. I'd say every chef in the country would have went for dinner one last time. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? It was just such a good guy. Like, I remember bumping into him not long after coming back from the States, and not a soul knows you, whatever, man. He spoke to me like he knew me my whole life.
Yeah.
I remember it was day one auditions for MasterChef.
Right.
Derry was first in and I was next in.
Okay.
Knew nobody. And like they made you feel like you were going to get the role. And I remember going up the stairs in the Burlington, and the first thing I saw was Derry, and just out of nervousness or whatever, he's like, "Oh, how you doing?" And we'd been at one or two Eurotalks things, but didn't really know each other. And I shook hands and I said, "I'm about to end your TV career, Derry." And just fell out of me. But he, like, thankfully he saw the humorous side of it. Yeah, you know, and he gave me a clip over there. He goes, "You cheeky wee bastard," or whatever, and away you go. But like from the first day I ever met him, man, and he comes to the K Club to me all the time. I see him a lot, and just a magic dude.
Like, the talent that went through those kitchens,
unreal.
And he was nearly everybody. He was never a dick ever. Yeah, yeah. You know, he'd be giving out a little bit, but not malice or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Genuine good, and he had great stories. Remember him telling me, we wrote his book, Dilek Van, and I read it because he had them in the staff room. And you get a break during the day, a split during the day, and you go up and I read the whole book. And he talked about the Y hour sauce with the brown, the rasher sandwich and the bag of chips. He lived up in Dundalk, but he lived in a farm up there before it was all built up. And he'd cycle down to the chipper, and you know, and then he'd say, after 20 minutes getting home, the salt and vinegar absorbs into the chips. And that's when you eat them, you know. And it's just all stuff. He's on Derry's bike with him going up because we're talking freeze and in my head and eating those chips. And I said it to him, and you know what? He wrote a lovely message on the book. He gave me a free book then. He wrote a lovely message. Enjoy your restaurant sandwich. And I still have it at home. It's in my mom's house. And just lovely fella.
Yeah, he sounds
great, great man, you know.
So come here, how do you split your week then, Anto? What does a week look like with the two restaurants then? Like, as far as, do you leave your head chefs to it, or do you get in the mixer, or?
Like, the Lair Street, like, we had to build that from scratch, you know. That was a building site.
Yeah.
Everything was stripped out, everything. So you had to start again. And we did it with the Pure Fit Out. They build a lot of the press up stuff around town. So the thing about them was that they could turn around in 3 months. Mm. You know, once they got the keys, 3 months later, the restaurant was built. I'd never seen that like that. So we were project managing that. That's the first time I took a step back from the kitchen to Mr. Fox. But I had a deadly sous chef there called Megan. Now she's in Australia now. And she's a mini me, but without the crap, you know. Just a better personality, more nurturing, friendlier.
Yeah.
Not all those things, but
She
had a feminine touch, and she was
no switch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she's a hot shot and she's brilliant, you know. And when that was happening, I still wrote the menus and stuff like that, and I still going for the training and all that stuff. And then Delircy opened. But then Delircy opened, like, Jimmy and Jane were there, and Scott, like, they were the manager from Oymshire, and the assistant manager from Oymshire came to Delircy. So had a really strong front of house with Jane and them. And then Jimmy was great as well. Like, Jimmy, what am I going to tell him about food, you know? In a year, you got a Michelin stars. And then I got to the point, it's like, what do I have to tell you about restaurants anymore? He's already hit the pinnacle.
Yeah.
So they run it. I don't really get involved too much. Just the business side of it and all that kind of stuff. There's still loads of questions about that, because as a chef, you never see the books until you own the place.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have to make sure all the money's there.
Learn the hard way,
And you're kind of, how does that work? And opening a company, building a company. And so fast before we signed the lease, so 6 months later after we signed the lease, we were open on December 1st. And December 4th is probably the worst time to open a restaurant, because you can't get staff, because nobody's leaving jobs. And then, like, everybody's booked in for that kind of Christmas thing, because it's such a demand. So we weren't that busy, but it was perfect that it gives that little bit of time to...
And did you approach it as a soft, or was it just you were a bit late to miss the booking window? Or
no, that's it. Like, time was money. We needed to open, you know, and the schedule was 3 months, and they finished up November 28th. Someone came in, cleaned it, and then we just, that was it.
May as well make something.
You know, 2 days later, we're open. We did friends and family and stuff like that, and invited people over and did a test run of service. And it went well, you know. It's stressful, though. It's really stressful. Mm. You know, you're out of your wheelhouse. He came from New York to Dublin and got handed the keys, you know.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Away you go.
Yeah, away you go. And that was it. And
then, the other thing then, though, too, is you've got the new restaurant bounce, kind of January, February, March, which maybe helps you pull
it was breaking even. And then Mr. Fox, like, I have an Australian guy there. He's been there 2.5 years now, and he's kind of given the reins now the last few months, because I started a new business because there's nothing else going on. 3-year-old, I started a new business, the whiskey company, Mr. Fox Whiskey. And that's, like, we got into Dublin Airport straight away, you know.
Wow.
It's really hard to get into Dublin Airport because there's millions of whiskey brands. Yeah. Everybody wants to get in there.
And how did you get that? On flavour?
We're in a can, you know. You probably have to do this. But they're in the can, the 100 ml can, nobody's doing it. So it's a different vessel you can buy it in, you know, and the branding and the color schemes are really interesting. So it's not conventional.
Lots of companies like cans, especially procurement people for,
yeah,
you know, it's better than glass and obviously plastic.
That's your one there, like,
and everything else, you know.
So the Mr. Fox is Parnell. That was his, he used that as an alias, checking into hotels with Catherine O'Shea. But that destroyed Parnell politically because he had an affair with a married woman. That's your own, Gareth. I dropped these in last week for use. So that's his bust from his poetry.
Is this a whiskey drink straight up or is it carbonated? Or
people ask me, is it a cocktail? And so it's a mix of something. No, it's 43% whiskey. Pure that's straight up whiskey. But that's a stout cask finish. So it's an 8-year-old whiskey finished in stout casks. And it's on the premium level, you know.
Yeah. How long did the branding take? You must have been working on this for months, right?
I knew the idea because his Monaco is the uncrowned king of Ireland. So we put a crown on the fox. So it tells the whole story of Parnell, the fox, and the uncrowned king.
The business.
So it's really cool. And a lot of gold foiling and embossing and stuff like that. And the color scheme comes from old Guinness advertising. We found those colors back in the 70s. And that's the can's finish. So the color scheme ties in how it's finished. That's an Oloroso Pedro Jimenez double sherry. And they found old sherry advertising those colors. So the colors look a bit old, you know, but
it's class.
It gives a bit of a, they look great, you know.
But I can see why the airport was like, actually, this looks
different from the norm.
Fox, you know, in a box.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fox in the box. Francis Jefferson, remember him?
Yeah. They're deadly. Wow.
So they're 100 ml, you can get them onto an airplane. It's portable, you can bring to a festival or
and
outdoor.
Where did all that end of it come from? Just somebody in design that was helping you and saying,
I went to a designer. I went to a, you know, when the way your phone listens to you, I wanted to start a whiskey bar and I sent it with a designer. You know, that, oh, thank you, phone people listening in on me. And then it was a back bar studio. So this guy called Connor and he works from his house up in Monaghan, but he redesigned the Grey Somali brand. I've never seen Grey Somali and also the Muff Liquor.
Yeah.
Ed Sheeran and Russell Crowe invested in their design for them as well. So we had a great pedigree and stuff like that. And I really liked those because it was told a story about an Irish figure with the Grey Somali. So then I just rang him and said, listen, I'm starting a whiskey brand. Do you want to come and have a chat with me? And he came, had a chat. But like.
So you've bought Irish whiskey that's already been
I bought it from distillery, you know. So
most, 5 years, isn't it? It needs to be
three years for Irish whiskey, 2 years for American and 3 for Irish and Scotch, but mostly it's 5 here, you know, because of the climate, you know. America's quicker, it's hotter, so the angel share happens quicker and the flavor penetrates to the wood and stuff like that, but Ireland's a bit slower, I think, you know. But I went to Whiskey Live, got an invitation to Whiskey Live from a guy that worked for Rowan Co. I met him, I dropped into Rowan Co. I was like, I'm opening a restaurant down the road. I want to do an Irish coffee. It's like Jimmy picks the whiskey up on his way into work and we're making the Irish coffee over. And he's a really friendly guy and he stayed in touch. Then he got me on the guest list for Whiskey Live and I went there on my own. Got sauced. And I went out. And I came out and you meet a bottle maker and you meet like a label maker and a box maker and a bonder and distilleries. And like, oh no, we can do it for you. I was like, oh no way. I was like, you can do that. So I wanted to do a little bottle for the restaurant to tell Mr. Fox story with some aged liquid. I wanted to get it from a distillery and stuff like that. And then a year later, there's a big factory out in Blanchardstown with big, huge machines.
I watched the videos. You sent me this stuff last week, like after I was on here scoffing about whiskey and how much it gets, how much it gets
sick.
It gets me sick and everything else, you know what I mean? And I was laughing. I was in Toka Park at the game when your messages came in and I was laughing. But the pictures of the warehouse. Yeah, you've really cracked on with it, huh?
Yeah, because no one will kind of for you. It's a different kind of... It's not aluminium, it's steel and the tin plated, so it's food grade. Like if you put that in an aluminium can, it corrode over time and it poison it, you know. So it's different technology for it, you know. So we had to build our own infrastructure because no one does the cans in Ireland.
Yeah.
Except the place up the north, they were forced to do it. And so you can't just ask someone else to come, so you have to build it. And that was a thing, you have to get the revenue involved, Department of Agriculture, they have to approve everything, the bond and the banks, stuff like that. So it's a huge undertaking.
Big,
I was like, so what's expensive real quick. It was like from a restaurant bottle, you know, from a single cask to like.
What's the best market for you? I mean, apart from the airport, obviously, like, but do you want to get into bars or restaurants? Like, where do you see it sitting?
Like, Dunn's are going to take it on board in September. So they're the biggest retailer in the country. That's huge. And then they'll take it on a trial basis, 24 stores, do a rollout, help you as much as they can. And then if it's successful, a national rollout then. Then, like, it'll just do another retailer. But the exports as well, like, just loads of people approach me like, can you can our liquids? And I never met these people before, you know.
Three people. There you go. Me. Yeah, that's another
and
way.
They never heard of me because I'm not in their industry.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knew he was doing it.
There's been a lot of concern in that world at the moment, right? With some some of the statements that are being made.
As the distilleries are all in trouble because the American markets, the turmoil with that, the uncertainty. But like
they're saying, is are they saying a 15% tariff now? Is that coming down?
So
because originally he said 50%, right?
Yeah.
And then he threw out the 200%, and then I heard a guy on News Talk Business one of the mornings, and which is I listened in the car on the way in, which is at whatever, 6:30, whatever. And he was I can't remember, I should remember, but he was a whiskey seller, I suppose, or a distiller. And he was like, look, until we get a definitive, he says, but the sales have dropped.
Yeah.
Because people kind of hedge fund with whiskey, they buy it and they can lay it down. And there's people that will go, right, I have money, I'll buy whiskey now and I own 50 bars or whatever. So.
Yeah. We're not in that situation because distilleries are in trouble because there used to be four distilleries in Ireland.
Yeah.
They all consolidated. There's Bushmills, Middleton, John Teeling, and Cooley, you know, and that was it. And then within 10 years.
It's 50 something, isn't it?
54.
Yeah, yeah.
So every year saying, well, and you have no stock for 3 years.
Yeah.
You can't call a whiskey until it's 3 years old. There's no such thing as.
That's where they all make gin.
The gin and vodka. Yeah.
But it's a byproduct, isn't it, really? Just
well, it's cash flow.
It's a cash flow thing, you know.
Not a byproduct. But I mean, it's rather than the machines not running.
Well, they can't make any money on the whiskey, so they've got to sell
vodka
some.
Can be made, distilled, and then put in the bottle straight
away.
That's
why they all make gin.
Gin infused in the bottle. But the whiskey can't be called whiskey until 3 years in a barrel, you know. But, like everybody's saying, idea, great idea, Irish whiskey, there is a growing market for it. But like Middleton control 75% of the global market. So it's 25% left for the other 53 distilleries, you know. Yeah. But we get our liquid from Great Northern Distillery. That's John Teeling's distillery. He used to force them to supply the independent market with their whiskey. Like Baileys and all used to buy it off him. Because Middleton won't give it to you and Bushmills won't give it to you. So there's no one else doing that. So he'd supply other brands. So most distilleries that just opened and they're in the 1-2 year period, they'd get their liquid from Great Northern Distillery.
Right.
They don't tell you that.
Is the next thing to go with your own recipes and blend it?
Yeah, we work with them and say the flavor profiles. What we like. They're saying like lean into your chef background and stuff like that.
Yeah. I did a lot of work for a few years during COVID on a company called Moto Bio. We were doing stuff where I was working with Kerry Global in Beloit, Wisconsin.
Oh, right, okay.
Spent a lot of years.
Yeah.
We had sensed. Look, I mean, we might have a chat about it afterwards, but we like some savage gear.
It's about to whip out a contract.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing what people do. Like I'd make stuff here, go to a lab. We'd send it from Kerry in Nace. They would go to Beloit, Wisconsin. They would dehydrate, make the drinks, powder them, sachet them. They would come back. We rejuvenate them in water and they would be milliliter perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd be, because there was no travel involved, that's how we were all doing it. Mm. It got right to the edge. Look, we never pushed on with it, but I mean, there was a huge
but
amount
of money spent
on it.
But it's fascinating in the world of alcohol because like sommeliers talk about like the finished product normally and they're able to talk about what happens to it wine when it lies down. And I've had a lot of conversations with people that make wine and I find it fascinating that they taste something or smell something and say, okay, if I put it in with this wood and I leave it alone for this time, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens in the world of whiskey, where naturally as a chef, when you taste something, you say, right, I need to add this in or I need to get it to do to, for it to taste different. So naturally our minds think, how do I do something to it to get it to change? Where there, it's like, you know,
they have to guess what it's going to taste like in 3 years, you know.
But normally these people are getting it close to real.
It's a science now.
It really is
a science. And the flavor comes from like all Irish, like 95% of Irish whiskey starts off in ex-bourbon barrels.
Right.
Because what happened back in, I think, back in the 1920s, they made legislation.
Prohibition or whatever.
You don't know, it was more about the crash after so they could only use a barrel once by law in America, so
keep
that kept
the
cooperage industry going and the forestry industry going.
Yeah,
but that crushed the European cooperages and thing because America had a glut of supply that's ready to go, so it was cheaper to buy the bourbon. So most whiskey in Ireland starts and in Scotland too starts off in ex bourbon barrel, so you get those kind of bourbon very sweet, you know. So it won't be smoky, but they char the inside the barrels,
yes,
and it gives that dark flavor, the color too. And it has that kind of caramelly thing because they make theirs with corn and stuff like that. So their liquid would be made. We make it with barley and corn and stuff and grain. But so everything starts off in bourbon. And then
I often think of the first person to think of it all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I know your mind's always busy, like, but like, who thought, you know what, let me burn the inside of the barrel?
No, it was more because the British Empire as well, as all boy, they were the kings of the sea, you know, the Royal Navy. So they transported it all over the empire and they put it in barrels and they had huge connections with Porto. And they bring their cask back and then they'd finish the Jameson in that and stuff like that. So that's how it evolved into
really
that.
But
it
all
started off, yeah, it started off as poaching basically, you know. They used to be more herbal and stuff. The original whiskies were more medicinal and herbal. The monks used to make it. So not how they started, like again, spirits in Europe. We were just beer. But they went, I think it's during the Crusades.
The Arabs
are making perfume. They're making perfume through distillation. Most perfume is just alcohol, flavor.
Yeah.
So they knew how to. Alcohol evaporates at 79 degrees Celsius. So before boiling point, the water. So if you just heat it at 79, the water will stay here and the alcohol will turn to vapor and go through the stills and then condense.
I went to I went to a bergamot factory down in right the very bottom of Italy.
And there was
this massive factory, right? And bergamot is like, if anyone has never seen one, it's like a mandarin.
Yeah.
But it's harder and like it's a little bit green. And they were making all these different things like bergamot sweets, soaps, all this type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a truck come in of an articulated lorry with all this fruit on it and it was dumped into this machine.
Yeah.
And then it got washed and skinned and all this stuff happened to her. Right? And the person that was showing us all the bits. And then we walked to the back of the factory and there was a pipe coming out of the top of the thing and there was this essence dripping.
Yeah.
And it was bergamot essence.
Oh, okay.
And he was like, the front part of the factory makes the least amount of money and the most amount of money we make is down here and that drip. And I was like, and what happens to that? And he was like, well, that goes straight to Paris, to all the perfume houses.
Okay, yeah.
And they were like, almost every perfume in the world has bergamot as a base scent.
Yes.
And it's the same. It was a distilled process. Yeah, I didn't really 100% understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you would think, who thought of I'm standing there going, the hell did it get from like squeezing oranges really is what we all are. But it's
you have to happen to you as a chef as well. Like, how did you come up with that? Like people are just bamboozled.
Yeah. Because I've eaten it somewhere else.
Because I'm training or walk or else I've seen it in a book or
But
which led you to what is it? I'm gonna say the walnut whip, the Mr. Fox walnut whip.
Yeah.
Super split.
Super split.
We call them the orange split in Donegal, but super split, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What is the right name of it? Is it super split or?
Yeah, it used to be called super split. They don't really have them anymore, don't they?
Not the one with the ice cream and
then the orange ice cream.
Yes. Like cordial.
But I love that. Fish. I used to muck around with different wee trifles as well.
Snickers, like, did you? Was that you, Gary? Did you not do a Snickers bar?
No. I've done a few different funky ones, but I know the first. I think it was the very first menu, Mr. Fox, with the walnut whip on it and the super ice burgers, another one,
That was it. Like, I had no pastry chef, so I kind of like wanted to make it playful and different, you know.
Mm. Yeah,
and
but you tap into nostalgia. Like,
yeah. Because all the clients start, they won't be tourists. It was all
Paddies.
Dublin people.
Yeah.
You know? And
business kinda, lunches, right?
Yeah, loads of that. So, and like, I call them time travel. If you have some people call it a Slero, we call it super splits. Ben's what kind of middle class or working out. But
I thought this was a tenner, was 19 euro.
But it had that magic of like you take a bite of it and it melts your mouth and it bring you back to when you're 14 or something. Yeah. I remember that and that's I call them time machines, you know. That was nostalgic and thing. And people loved it, you know. People were slagging us, what are you doing that for?
Oh, no. That's what an asshole would say.
They're like £7 or something. It was a big dessert or whatever, you know. There was like, you get letters in the post and all.
People are mad, aren't they?
Oh, the rest of me was great because it was all French fundamentals and like really good stuff. And then I'd cheapen it by doing
a bit of crack.
Playfulness and nostalgia. But it was like we'd get in like clementines from France and juice them and like it was proper gear, like a vanilla from Madagascar.
I did the carrot and parsnip for the Eurotalks AGM in February too. It was a plain carrots and parsnip, but it was a dessert.
I read the menu and I texted him, was like, you sure? He was it's very good. All right.
Yeah, it was deadly. But I'd eaten a version of it many years ago in New York in Del Posto.
Yeah, okay.
What do you call the madman with the orange crocs?
Mario Battalion.
Too touchy. Yeah, Mario. Yeah.
Mario got cancelled a few years ago. But anyway, back in the day, Del Pasto had carrot and parsley. Now, it was just a basic carrot cake and a parsley ice cream. The one we did was a lot more refined, but the fundamental idea had come from tasting it over there. Anyways, Anto, we always like to wrap it up with a death row dinner. I know you tune in every now and again, so you've probably heard all the weird and wonderful we've had.
No, it's like death row. If people get, you get arrested and put in prison here? Is it the inmates are cooking it for you?
You can get whoever you want. That's the rules too.
Your final meal or your thing.
It's your last supper.
You haven't ordered anybody around like that. No.
Okay. You can even pick who makes it for you if you don't want to do it yourself.
Do you know what? I did listen to that episode. I was like that. Oh, do you know what? It's a good question because it makes you think about what was the best things you ever had in your life.
Yeah.
What made you feel the best? Mm. Right, maybe. But like, I'd probably, like, the most comforting thing I've ever eaten in my life was a French onion soup, you know?
Yeah.
And I was in a restaurant in Brooklyn and my buddy just opened. It was an old garage auto body shop converted into a restaurant. So still, and they got a Michelin star, but it was like, did a thing, he made it with Vidalia onions. Obviously, Vidalia onions,
yeah.
They're sweeter than our onions, you know. And that was the base. And he put Brooklyn beer into it, like a dark lager, and made his own beef stock and stuff. And the croutons were about that thick, and the bowl was about that size, and the cheese was about 4 slices of cheese on top. And they were all caramelized, the boiling on the side of the bowl was all caramelized.
It's the hottest liquid in the world.
Yeah. And it's one thing you want to eat more, just and you're born in and everything.
Blisters on your face.
Your cheek gets on your chin, you'd be scarred for the rest of your life. But it was one of them. I couldn't believe it. I was like, that's the nicest thing I've ever had in my life. And it was obnoxiously big because the Americans, everything's bigger.
Everything's big. You need a ladle to fucking eat it.
And they had a fish tank with rainbow trout in it and used to catch them and then kill them straight away and then steam them in an old fish kettle and stuff like that. Really funky, and an oyster bar and stuff. It was really cool. Unconventional restaurant, you know, and he worked with me in Veritas, you know.
Yeah.
And he worked in Robichon, the mansion, Robichon, 3-star Michelin place.
Veritas, you know. Anthony Bourdain loved Veritas.
Yeah.
He had a buddy working in there.
Scott Bryan.
Scott Bryan.
He wrote a chapter about Veritas called The Life of Bryan, you know, the Monty Python sketch.
Yeah.
And he went to Veritas and just observed. And he couldn't believe what he's seen. He goes, that girl with her Ducasse in the Essex house. And he'd be like, he'd be flipping a certain way. And he's like, oh, we used to use the tongs. You know? But he wrote a whole chapter and it's like romanticized. But I was sous chef in Veritas in New York, you know. So, and when I remember reading that book, I lived in Australia. I had a mattress and a backpack and that was it. Like, it looked like something out of Trainspotting, you know. But there was two books in the corner. It was Irvin Welch's Glue and it was also Kitchen Confidential. And I read the, and then I went to New York and ended up working there, but I didn't know. I didn't put it together.
Yeah.
So someone said to me, Gino, the restaurant manager goes, that's in Tony Bourdain's La Halle's just around the corner. I was like, oh man, this is deadly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my main course, I don't know, like I was thought about that. I was like, I think like one of the most comforting things I ate when I was a kid, my mom's lasagna is the most exotic we ever got, you know. But she nailed it, you know.
Yeah.
One of them, and we had a big family, just 7 of us, you know. You got a tray lasagna, you got a big
My cousin, his mammy used to make it spaghetti bolognese. And I used to actually go home to my mammy and say, poor Paul, like his mammy's cooking that, his mammy's cooking that weird shit again for him. I was like spaghetti bolognese, just like who gives?
No, none of my neighbors.
Why is he not getting spuds?
None of that stuff. None of that fancy stuff for me neighbors. You won't even tell them you had lasagna.
Oh, Jesus.
But
it's like pasta, fucking weirdos.
Yeah. Just have really good memories of that, you know. But I'd want to make it myself now.
Big thing with lasagna in an Irish house, with or without coleslaw.
Yeah, coleslaw.
Oh yeah, essential.
Yeah,
feta chips.
You're not supposed to say that as a chef. Look at you like you're fucking stupid. You know?
Well, green salad plays dressed.
No, but even my missus, like, she's like, did you get the coleslaw?
It does work.
Oh yeah,
lightens it. Cuts right through the fat. Yeah.
It's deadly.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. No, we do. We had the sneaky coleslaw with it as well.
Oh yeah, it has to be done.
What are you finishing off on?
I'd say something simple like a creme brulee or
9 pints
with a ginger nut. I used to make my own ginger nuts before and I nailed it. It was Delia Smith's recipe. She puts fresh ginger and dry ginger in it. And I made it one time during lockdown because I had to come up with loads of ideas for desserts and stuff that would travel. Mm. Perfect for the home cook just to finish. And I made loads. So I read loads of cookbooks for that kind of stuff. Delia and Dorina Allen and stuff. And I found that and I was like, that's exactly as the packet. Exact. And it was the, because we tried a few recipes. It was just because it's dry and the fresh ginger and it was perfect, you know. And so creme brulee with that, it like a deadly creme brulee, loads of vanilla.
Yeah.
Or else a tiramisu, you know.
Louise creme brulee with like 85 vanilla puffs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The whole show's budget was gone. Can we get an extra chef? No, we spent on vanilla.
We used to look at desserts in the restaurant. There's just no budget, man. It's hilarious.
She's right.
We'd be bent over like going like, is it possible that there's 67 pots of vanilla? Like, sorry Louise, just slagging there, you know what I mean? But yeah, you know, you're clearly not buying them.
No, definitely not.
Oh man, it was so good. Look,
when people look at you sideways, what's your favourite food? Look, like a sandwich, you know.
Mm. Yeah. You sent me myself a ham salad sandwich the other day.
Ever. Yeah. We appreciate someone else cooking for us, but people are terrified to cook for
you. Yeah, yeah.
And it's so annoying.
Yeah, they won't cook for you. Don't invite you over or anything. Yeah, yeah.
Give us anything. Like.
Yeah. Now, anybody that puts a bit of effort into their hands to you, it's the nicest feeling in the world.
Yeah.
It's so nice.
Because it's so rare.
Yeah, it's so rare. Yeah. And
are you married yet, Anto? No, well, your partner, but does she cook at home? Or?
She does. She was a good cook before I met her, but like she'd be watching me cook and taking up stuff and with that. You've been watching me, have you? You know, just a certain way. It was absolutely disaster, shit everywhere, but she doesn't know how the cleaners go or empty dishwasher before she starts, you know. But she's a great cook, absolutely great. She's some deadly recipes, like she's a lovely chicken casserole.
It's just messy, it's just a mess.
No, like she tries to stay on top and then it just get, you know, lunchtime.
Over for
playing is just fucking. And it happens to me as well. Like, you've had a few minutes before I go back in there, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, but deadly. You, like, I don't think I'm the best home cook, you know, I'm a great restaurant cook. I love systems and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But to do that at home, of course, different kind of focus, and I don't love it, you know.
Yeah.
And because you'd work like 80, like when you work in New York, it was like 78 euros a week. It was crazy. Yeah. And over there, you go out all the time. Go for brunch, you go for dinner. It was so cheap, and you know, you weren't going anywhere.
Well, it's cheaper to eat out in America than cook at home.
And the culture over there was eating out, you know. Yeah. Nobody had proper cookers around like that, you know. You didn't even have a washing machine in your house over there because you just get your laundry done. You drop off the bag at the end of the week and pick it up the next day. So there wasn't that kind of cooking at home thing. You'd be mad if you cooked at home, you know. So I don't know. And I always kind of rented. I never really had my own place to call home, you know. And so I never really loved
getting stuck in at home. Yeah, wow.
You have a nice kitchen at home, don't you? I see in your videos with your kids.
Yeah, I done. That was at the start of lockdown. I was very lucky. And I think I told you this before, Gary, but the builder was just about to, he'd done the foundations out the back and he was just about to take the back door out and the lockdown happened.
Right.
So we were like, I was doing video. I mean, we were all trying to just keep going. I was doing videos and you couldn't see it from the videos, but I had a makeshift kind of cooking section put up. And then as lockdown went on, the surroundings got a bit nicer because the, you know, the building started again and then the kitchen got finished. But no, I think it's in our home and anyway, the kitchen is the most important room in the house. Like, you know, it's
big time. Yeah.
It's where it's where we hang out together as a family. And
I keep saying to her, we'll get the forever home, you know. Yeah. It's like, do you want to open a restaurant? What is that whiskey company? It's like,
whiskey garage first.
Real, we've spent everything now. Everything's gone now.
Yeah.
We're not getting that house for a while.
But, well, listen, best of luck with Fox
and thank you very much for the whiskey.
Yeah. Mr. Fox's whiskey.
It'd be a good gift to re-gift or...
No,
cocktail, dude, you know, even a ginger ale would be lovely.
Give it a rattle.
Yeah.
Give it a rattle for
sure. Thanks, Anto. Thanks for coming.
And best of luck with Mr. Fox on Delir Street.
We'll be in to see you.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Anto.
Yeah, thanks a million.
Good to see you, brother.
So there you go. There's a lot of things I didn't know about Anthony.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you this much, he's an entrepreneur.
Yeah. He always had that streak about him, you know. It's great. Like, he's doing well. I mean, like, it's tough to have one restaurant on the go, like, to have two on the go and two very successful ones at that. I mean, Mr. Fox is...
Yeah, I've had some beautiful meals
there. Mr. Fox is amazing. It's one of the best restaurants in the country. It really genuinely is.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
Absolutely top drawer.
And I'm going to make it my business now to go to the Lear Street because I've... Yeah. He's asked me a couple of times to go and I've, you know, I'm going to go. That's it. I'm definitely going. We should go.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm hearing brilliant things about it. And he's such a soft type of a character, you know, which you wouldn't expect that he's out setting up whiskey brands and opening second restaurants. That's winning.
I love dudes that got low. They're hustling and just pushing on and like... gets an idea, I want to do it. Do you know what?
I wouldn't like to be in his shoes when his wife's listening to the podcast. Yeah.
I've just spent all our money on a warehouse.
I'm just going to put it on loop for the entire
Yeah.
Fair play to him though, you know what I mean? Like, it's, do you know what? a firm believer in putting yourself under a wee bit of pressure financially. Sure. It keeps the graft in your soul, and you push on.
Well, it was more the fact that he's given out about her that she doesn't clean up after herself.
There's that too. But you know what? The whiskey hopefully will take off for him, and he'll just be buying a bigger, nicer gaffer in a couple of years. So wait a few more years, and it'll be worth it, because there's no two ways about it. Like, he's going to be successful.
Not for sure. Yeah. He's already successful. Look, his whiskey brand is I know we spoke about it at length there, but it's a very, very cool thing and super gift.
Yeah, but even when he's talking about the wee fox there, and he's going around Parnell and the crown and whatever, like, every little minute detail is thought out. Exactly. Magic, you know.
Oh, Ed, over to you, our favourite part of the week, where Ed Chef takes the reins and gives us our culinary credentials.
Thanks, as ever, to everyone who's been sending them in. food@goloudnow.com. We're starting off in Cork. As you should, really, whatever you're doing. All right, lads, love the pod. Quick one for you. Is there a way to rescue a curry that's after getting way too spicy? I thought I was being clever with the chili flakes, but now it's basically lava. Any chef's tricks before I burn the head off the family, Claire in Cork?
Yeah, well, for me, natural yogurt and lemon juice is probably the first two things that spring to mind. If they don't work for you, another little trick is actually to bulk it out. So say if it's a chicken and veggie one, and what you got to do then is maybe...
Man up and just eat it. That's what you...
cook more veg, brown off more chicken and vegetables or whatever. Add in a decent amount of Sharwood's, must be Sharwood's mango chutney for a bit of sweetness. Oh my goodness, Then add in your curry and thicken it and... but without any spice, like you feed in the original batch that you've made and you've added more veg or whatever, and then add a bit more chicken stock or vegetable stock and then, you know, whatever way you're using to thicken it, whether it's roux based or Birmani or whatnot, reduce it down and get it thicker. But bulking it out, or if you don't want to go to the bother or the expense of that, lemon juice and lime juice as well as natural yogurt are really, really good tricks for cutting it. You should always serve a curry as well, like with a little bit of little dollop of yogurt is nice. Natural yogurt, a nice good thick, well strained natural yogurt, so it's nice and smooth and thick, you know.
Thank you, and best of luck with that, Claire. Now we're going to Galway next. Hi Gary and hi Gareth, love the pod. I keep hearing about this thing called, I mean, mispronouncing this, miso paste. Or is it miso? Anyway,
miso.
But I've never had a clue what to actually do with it. Is it just for soups, or can I lash it into other stuff? Would love a bit of inspiration. Thanks a million, Connor from Galway.
Miso is basically from the world of Japan. It's a fermented soybean paste, and it can be used for loads of different things. It's brilliant in marinades. It's very good for vinaigrettes and dressings. So if you think of a classic French dressing, you could add a little bit of miso paste in at the start with some grated ginger and maybe a splash of mirin, and then follow the things that we speak about all the time. So a dressing like a 3-to-1, 3 part fat, 1 part citrus. You could use lime juice. And then to have that in a salad where you could be some chicken and some nashi pear or some apple and some bean sprouts, and then you add in this miso dressing, it'd be delicious. It works really well for marinating fish.
Yeah, cod. There's a very famous miso cod in Nobu.
Yeah, and it's basically just where you take the miso paste and you knock it back a little bit with some oil, and then you can add some seasonings to it. And then you need to be careful because it's fermented, so it's salty. If you're adding it to something, it's going to start to cure the fish for you a little bit. But yeah, it's the type of ingredient that you see in the supermarket. I mean, it can obviously be added into soups and things. That's really where the obvious place with it is to go. But if you think of it like a soy sauce. Yeah, it's salty.
Is it expensive, did you say?
It can be. Yeah. Like, you can get different grades of it. You can buy very expensive miso paste. But if you think about when you add soy sauce to a stir fry or something, it's a paste version. Like, so it's this... I'm not crazy in that word umami, but it is that kind of other salty flavor, like that soy sauce. It's a very high umami flavor.
Have you had it, Ed?
No.
Oh, I'm surprised. I can tell by your face. Intrigued.
It sounds amazing. I like my savory.
Ed looks like it's very savory.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm shocked that you haven't had much of it, because it's. I'll tell you what like you could do.
If you wanted to just a very basic thing, if you just bought some miso, you knock the back with a little bit of oil, chop some garlic, good squeeze of lemon juice, and then rubbed it over a chicken.
Oh, yeah.
And then go back a couple of episodes, Gary spoke about how to roast a chicken, bang it into the oven, follow what Gary said, and you'll get a very, very delicious, different roast chicken that you could have with some noodles or some fried rice.
The two of you are going to have to release a cookbook.
It's coming.
Associated.
It's coming.
Is it?
We're thinking about it. Yeah.
Get the fuck.
Yeah.
Associated with the podcast.
Yeah, and
a cut for me. Brilliant.
Yeah.
So we're moving.
Sorry, you're breaking up there. You're breaking up.
I'm going to bring that up. I'll bring that up in the next story. We're heading up to Donegal. Oh, of course.
Jesus.
Do you know Deirdre? You probably do. Anyway, Deirdre's been on. Gary and Gareth, please help. Yep. Every time I make brown bread. There's a chef that keeps driving past my house, and every time I make brown bread, it comes out like a brick. I follow the recipe to the letter, but it could be used for self-defense. What am I doing wrong? Yours in desperation, Deirdre in beautiful Donegal.
Oh, well, the first thing that springs to mind is you're
probably, rid of the recipe.
is the recipe's poor, because, I mean, there's nothing that could be easier to make, really. The ratios sound like they're all wrong. Your oven temperature could quite possibly be too high, and you may be baking it too long.
It depends. Does she mean it's too hard on the outside, or is it too dense?
It's probably too dense.
Yeah.
It's probably too
dense.
There's
two things that's wrong. It's either being overcooked or it's being under aerated. And what I mean by that is maybe the recipe says tablespoon and she's putting in a teaspoon of bicarb or something. That could be happening. But what I would say is scratch that recipe. Jump onto either one of our socials and know that I've brown bread recipes up there.
If you go on
and they're bulletproof.
My Instagram, go and
make Gary's Guinness bread.
The Guinness bread recipe is foolproof. And I'm telling you now, you'll struggle to make a nicer one, you know.
It is delicious.
Great. Well, there you go. Words from the horse's mouth themselves. Get on to Gary's Guinness bread. And thanks to everyone from Galway, Cork, and Donegal this week. Keep them coming in. Food at goladnow.com.
So there you go, another episode done and dusted, and some good chat as always. I really love when we get a chef in, because I think it gives the podcast a really different feel.
Yeah, no, big time, yeah. And Anto was a great guest, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I'm always mindful of, and please let us know if we're getting too chefy, because I think naturally if any tradespeople are talking, there's a bit of jargon spills in. So we love hearing any feedback. So as always, like and follow us on socials, give us any feedback, make sure you're following us on whatever platform you're listening to, and dishing it out, so that really helps the pod, and we're enjoying I'm getting told here by the powers that be, Ed keeps telling us that the numbers are going up.
Up.
We've people listening, we've more people, share it with your pals, and be sure to tune in next week and we'll chat to you then.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.